Lecture 8, Evil, Free Will, Original Sin, and Predestination.
Augustine, Philosopher and Saint, Lecture Number 8. In this lecture, we're continuing a series of studies of Augustine's key concepts, especially concerning the doctrine of grace. In the previous lecture, we focused on faith, love, and grace. Here, we're going to look at the dark side of things. We're going to look at doctrines that make people uneasy, like the doctrine of original sin, the doctrine of predestination, and also, well, the doctrine of evil. After all, if we're going to look at the dark side, we might as well start with evil. And that was a big question for Augustine. Remember back in the Confessions when he was still struggling with trying to understand the nature of God, he was also trying to understand the origin of evil. He asked the question, where does evil come from? Whence is evil? Unde malum in the Latin, a famous question. Well, in Confession 7, after that brief glimpse of the eternal shining truth of God, he came upon a solution for this question, where does evil come from? And we need to set that solution out so that we can all look at it, and we'll be using that as we go forward here. First premise for Augustine's doctrine of evil is that God created all things, and he created them all good. Right? Now that's a lot to say, because that means, as Augustine says straight out, that everything that exists is good. God created all things. God didn't create anything evil. Therefore, all things that exist are good. And he says that. Everything that is good. That means that evil is, in some sense, a form of non-being. Evil is, let's say, real, but it's not a form of being. It is a corruption in being. Like, for instance, a torn garment. The tear, the rip, the hole is evil, right? It's bad for the garment. The garment has gone bad because of that hole in it. The hole isn't a thing. It isn't something that God created. It isn't a being. It is a form of absence or lack or non-being. Something that ought to be there isn't there. So evil always has that character of absence, of non-being, of privation, of lacking things that ought to be there. There's not only holes in shirts, which are, you know, bad for the shirt. There's the rottenness in a sick tree. And in fact, the word corruption is closely related to the word for rot. So when anything's getting rotten, decaying, that's evil. Because a tree ought not to have rot in it, right? It ought to have this good, healthy fiber, and instead it's got something else. Or think of disease in a body, right? If you're sick, the body that you have is made by God. It's a good thing, but the disease is something missing in your body. Or think especially, in a favorite metaphor of Augustine's, think of blindness in your eye, right? The eye is meant to see. If it's blind, then it's missing something that it ought to have. And what it's missing is something good, but the fact that it's missing it is evil. So that's the character of evil. It's not something that had to, you know, come into being somehow, and therefore God never created evil. And the other thing to be aware of about evil is that we often think that things are bad because we don't like them. But in the structure of the whole universe, better things and worse things are all good together. For instance, a stone is not as good as a tree because a tree is alive, and a tree is not as good as a dog or a cat because dogs or cats are animals and trees are only plants. And human beings are better than dogs and cats because they're rational. So there's a whole scale of better and worse. But the worst things aren't evil. They're just less good than the better things. And so even if we don't like certain of these things, if we don't like mud or we don't like mosquitoes, that doesn't mean they're evil. They're part of a good universe. They're inconvenient when they're out of place, and when they get out of place, that's evil, right? Disorder and things out of place is evil. Things aren't when they're not where they're supposed to be. But the things themselves are all good. Now, last point about evil. Evil originates from free will. And so, it's interesting. In this lecture on the dark side of Augustine's doctrine of grace, this is where we have to discuss free will. Because Augustine uses the concept of free will to talk about where evil came from. So far, the kinds of evil we've been talking about are not sin, right? Even blindness or rottenness in a tree or disease, those aren't sin. those aren't where evil ultimately came from. The origin of evil, the root of all evil, is our sin. Going back to Adam and Eve, which we'll talk about in a minute. That means that the deepest and most important kind of evil to understand is sin. And that comes from our will, our free will. Augustine uses the concept of free will to explain where evil ultimately came from. So we need to talk about what will is. We've been using the word a lot, and it's very familiar. But Augustine is one of the great theorists of the concept of will. And so he's doing something new with this concept. Well, what is will? Will is the power of choice. Think of the difference between a power and what you do with the power, between a power and an act. Your eye is a power. It's something you can do something with. It has an ability. But the act of the eye is to see. So the eye is different from the act of seeing, right? Well, likewise, the will is different from the act of the will. And the act of the will is love. What the will does when it's in action is love, just like what the eye does when it's in action is see. Right? The will is a power of choice, which is the power to make choices, but also the power to love. And in fact, all of our choices, all of our willing is driven by love or is some form of love. Right? Every time we use our will, we are loving something. And remember, love seeks to be united to some good. And, of course, everything that exists is good. Some things are better than others, but everything that exists is good. So you can't love anything that's evil, in a certain sense, because everything you love is good. But you can love in an evil way. If you love money in a way that you shouldn't, that's evil. The money isn't evil, right? It's your love for it, your excessive love for it, your seeking happiness in money. That's what's evil. So sin, you see, is, in Augustine, the perversity of the will. And perversity does not mean pervertedness like in sexuality or something. It means a turning away. It's literally a Latin word meaning to turn away. So sin is turning our will away from God, whom we should be loving, and turning it toward lower things, earthly things, like money. Loving money for its own sake, or loving anything on earth for its own sake apart from God. That perversity of will is what sin is. Sin is the will turned wrong, bent, twisted, like a tree that's sick and bent, right? If a tree gets sick, it's going to get perverted, right? Twisted, right? When our will is sick, it gets twisted downward, where it doesn't belong. We should be going this way instead of going that way. Remember, our love is our weight. When our love is a weight that drags us down, that's a perverse will, and that's sin. Now, free will for Augustine, and will is always free. Free will for Augustine is a way of talking about the fact that the will in us is free from external coercion. That is to say, unlike our bodies, no one outside of us can compel us to do something with our will, right? Someone can take my body anywhere they want to if they're stronger than me and they tie me up and they can make me do things with my hands and legs and whatever that I don't want to do. But they can't do that to my will. So no external coercion works against the will. And that's what it means to be free in one's will or to have free will. Our freedom of will is freedom from external coercion. But, interestingly enough, for Augustine, our freedom of will is not freedom from God. For one thing, God never coerces us externally. God does affect our will and influence our will. And when he does so internally, not externally. That's going to be a key point. Our will is related to God, intrinsically related to God. It's not something that's sort of separate from God's creation, as if we would be freer if we were far from God or apart from God. Quite the contrary. This is a key point about the relation of grace and free will. One way of putting this is that for Augustine, true freedom is freedom for the good, not freedom for the evil. This is interesting because this is a point where Plato and St. Paul, or the Platonist tradition and the Bible, agree. True freedom is freedom for the good. True freedom is freedom to love what will make you happy, right? If you are loving what's going to make you miserable, why would you call that freedom, right? Yes, we do have the freedom to make mistakes. But is that exactly freedom, right? If I trip and fall, would you call that freedom, right? If my eye is half blinded through my own fault, would you call that freedom? Well, Augustine doesn't want to call it freedom, right? Blindness is not a form of freedom. Falling down is not a form of freedom. Making a mistake is not a form of freedom. They're errors or defects, right? That they have that character of something missing that all evil has, right? Error, defect, something wrong, that's evil. Evil is not a form of freedom. It's a defect. It's something lacking in our free will. It's our free will being perverted and turned the wrong way. So the opposite side of the coin is, for Augustine, sin is always a form of bondage. And again, this is a notion that goes back to St. Paul in the Bible. Sin is a form of bondage. We are not exactly free to sin. We're free to make mistakes. We're free to sin. In that sense, we are free to sin, right? When we sin, we do it of our own free will. But Augustine won't call that a form of freedom. He'll call it a form of bondage. Remember the image from Confessions, Book 8, where Augustine wants to love God with his whole heart, mind, and strength, but he can't because this other sinful will, which is still his will, is tying up the will that wants to love God like a chain, right? He's made a chain out of his own will. So the will, the sinful will, is like bondage, not like freedom, right? Whereas loving what makes you happy, that's freedom. Okay. So this is very crucial when we get to the interaction of grace and free will in just a minute. But let's go back now to the origin of evil. That makes us all think, probably, of original sin, and probably of Adam and Eve. And it makes Augustine think of those things too. Because of Adam's sin, we are born with a corrupted nature, says Augustine. This is a key term, a technical term, corrupted nature. It's a very peculiar notion. Remember that corruption means something like decay or rottenness? Normally, it's an individual tree that's rotten, right? The nature of a tree doesn't get rotten. An individual tree gets rotten. The tree nature doesn't go bad. The individual tree goes bad. But Augustine's saying that with the human race, what's gone bad is not just individuals, right? It's not just that Adam is corrupt or some public official is corrupt, but human nature has been corrupted. Human nature has been spoiled. Human nature has a kind of career through history that went wrong with Adam. So we have a corrupted nature. It's as if human nature itself is suffering from a disease. Because of this corrupted nature, we find it impossible not to sin, says Augustine. We cannot not sin. We're no longer free to be free from sin the way that Adam was before he committed the first sin. Before Adam ate that apple, he was free not to sin. But now we are in bondage, right? We're not capable of being sinless. We're not capable of loving the way we should. Now, we need to get a key terminological distinction here. Adam's sin is not what Augustine means by original sin. When he talks about Adam's sin, Augustine will talk about the first sin. Original sin is our sin, which we have in Adam. Original sin is our connection to Adam's first sin, right? But original sin is in me. The first sin is what Adam did way back when, right, in the biblical story about eating that fruit from the forbidden tree. But original sin is here, or rather, well, not literally physically in my body. It's in my soul, in my will, in that corrupted human nature that belongs to me. So original sin is my sharing in Adam's guilt. And I mean here objective guilt, right? Not guilt feelings. But the objective fact that Adam was guilty of sin is somehow shared with me because somehow I'm connected deeply, inwardly with Adam. And therefore, I am guilty of that first sin along with Adam. That's what original sin means. It's more than just the fact that I'm born with a corrupted nature, because I could be born innocent, you know, like a baby, right? Born innocent, but still have this corrupted nature so that, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to be grow up twisted, right? Human beings seem to do that, where we seem to be born innocent and we never quite turn out perfect, do we? But Augustine's saying more than that. It's not just that we have a corrupted nature which makes it hard for us not to sin. The very moment we're born, we are guilty. We are literally born guilty. Adam's sin is somehow our fault. Now, this is a very paradoxical notion, but it's crucial to Augustine. Now, let me make a key distinction, of course. original sin is not the only sin we commit, right? After we grow up, we get to do some of our own sinning, which is not Adam's sinning. The technical term for that is actual sin, where I go out and, you know, murder someone or say unkind words to someone or whatever. That's my own sin. But I start out, even before that point, even before I sin on my own hook, I sin, or I'm guilty of, sinning in Adam. I'm going to have to spend some time explaining that in the last lecture. You're going to have to wait for that, I'm afraid. There's some fancy metaphysics that go with that. But Augustine's convinced that in some deep sense, we are united with Adam in sin. We share that first sin. And we'll get back to that in the last lecture. Right now, let me just point out a key consequence of that teaching. And that is that if an infant dies without being baptized, the infant is damned. Augustine teaches a doctrine of infant damnation. This is one of those doctrines that we, all of us, most of us at least, wish that Augustine had not taught. And I'm even going to suggest a little bit later that he didn't have to teach this doctrine. But he, in a sense, he wanted to teach this doctrine in order to have a club to beat the Pelagians with. Right? The Pelagians thought we didn't need grace to please God, right? We didn't need grace in order to become righteous. And Augustine says, well, wait a minute. If we didn't need grace, why did we baptize infants? Even infants need grace. Otherwise, we wouldn't go to the trouble of baptizing them. Infants are born under condemnation, justly condemned, because they are justly condemned for being guilty of Adam's sin. Right? When God condemns an infant, it's not unjust, Augustine argues, because the infant really is guilty of Adam's sin. And that's why if the infant is not baptized, and in baptism sin is forgiven, if the infant isn't baptized, the infant is damned. And Augustine seriously teaches that. And that's one of the legacies of Augustinian theology that the West has had to wrestle with for over 1,000 years. It has caused a great deal of heartache. Now that's one of two of the most uncomfortable doctrines in Augustine's teaching. Let me go to one more thing before we get to the most uncomfortable doctrine of all, which is predestination. Let me talk a little bit about the interaction of grace and free will, which is a key theme. Augustine believes that our will is always free, right? Sometimes it's not free enough to do what we ought to do, but we never will anything unfreely. We are never compelled to will anything. Now, this notion of free will has to come into contact with the notion of grace, where grace, for Augustine, is this inner gift of God, and it's an inner connection with Christ. Just as original sin is an inner connection with Adam, so our souls are either gravitating in Adam's direction through original sin, or gravitating in Christ's direction by being joined to the church, which is Christ's body. Grace, remember, is this sort of inward power of eternal beauty, when God reveals his beauty to us, to our inner selves, so that we can delight in God and enjoy God and love God and do what God wants us to do, because it's easy to do what someone you love wants you to do. Grace, therefore, heals our will. That's the first relationship between grace and will to think about. Our will, remember, is diseased, corrupted because of this corrupted nature. Right? It's a power that's not able to do what it ought to do, like an eye that's so diseased that it can't see very well. So grace is a healing power. It gives us eyes to see the beauty and truth of God. It heals that mental vision. Also, in addition to healing, grace helps. That is, it strengthens us so that even though our mind's eye is not fully recovered yet, we're still convalescing, as it were, with the help of grace, we're strengthened to see more and more. God helps us along day by day, giving us the strength to do what we ought to do, giving us the strength to love as we ought to love, right? To see what we ought to see, to love what we ought to love. So grace is always dealing with our will. The target of grace, for Augustine, is our will. It gets to our will inwardly, not through external means, but fundamentally inwardly, and it changes our will. It heals our will so that we can love better. It helps our will to perform individual acts of love that maybe we're not strong enough for. But in all these things, grace comes to us inwardly, not outwardly. Grace is not a form of coercion or compulsion. God is not forcing us to love, right? After all, love isn't like that. But on the other hand, remember, love is not something that we choose to do either, right? Love, I don't choose to fall in love, but I can't be forced to fall in love either, right? Somehow, you see someone who's wonderful, and you fall in love with them. You say, they're lovely. That's a great word, lovely, right? The beautiful person is lovely. Well, God is lovely. And grace is the loveliness of God getting into our hearts and changing our hearts. That's not external compulsion, but also it's not something we can choose on our own hook, right? But because that grace gets into our hearts and the loveliness of God changes our hearts, we do make choices. We make the right choices. We choose to obey God. We choose to love our neighbor as ourselves and to love God with our whole mind, heart, mind, and strength. So grace gives us the power to make the right choices. Likewise, as a result of this, grace is the basis of merit, or desert, or earning. Remember the kind of childish notion of religion where you earn your way to getting a reward in heaven, right? By saying, I do a good thing, God rewards me. Well, Augustine thinks that that notion of reward has a place. God does reward good deeds. That's why you can get away with them, right? In this dark and evil world, you often get punished for doing the right thing. Well, God reverses that and rewards you for doing the right thing. So the notion of merit or reward is important, but it's not fundamental. It's secondary. What's fundamental is grace. Grace changes our heart, teaches us to love and make the right choices, and as a result, we do things that are worthy of being rewarded. We do earn merit before God, but it's a merit that we couldn't have earned on our own. Right? It's a merit that God, in effect, gives us by giving us grace and teaching us to love, that we make the right choices and therefore earn merit. So there is a kind of earning a reward, but it's part of a larger story where grace is the fundamental force. One last point about grace and free will, and that's a tricky point that leads us into predestination. There's a special grace called perseverance. Think of it this way. When you're baptized, as a Catholic, your sins are forgiven. Got a clean slate, right? Original sin is gone, and all your actual sins up to this point are gone. And now you've got a life to live for the rest of your life until you die. And you're determined to live as a good Catholic and a Christian and to grow in love and faith. But after all, you have 20, 30, 40, 50, 70 years more to live. And the choices you make right now cannot determine the choices you're going to make 50 years from now. So you cannot decide right now that you're going to persevere in faith and hope and love till the end. You have to live out your life. And nothing you choose now is going to determine how your life will end. And if you end your life outside of charity, outside of the church, right, rebelling against God, then you end up damned. So nothing you do now can guarantee that at the end of your life, you're going to be in a state of grace, so you'll be saved, right? No choice you make at the present moment in your life can guarantee that you'll be saved in the end. Right? Because no choice you make right now can guarantee the whole course of your life. In order to be saved in the end, you have to be given what Augustine calls the gift of perseverance. You have to persevere to the end in faith and hope and charity. And that's a sheer gift. You cannot choose to get it. You can only pray for it, which is how you get grace in general. The only way you get grace is by praying for it. You pray for the gift of perseverance, and God, in his mercy and kindness, gives that gift to you. But now we're getting to the point where we see, once again, how much of our lives is not in our own power, is not subject to our own choice. After all, this is somewhat realistic. Our own choices only make so much of a difference in our lives, but it makes people very nervous that our own choices make so little difference or don't make all the difference when it comes to God. And Augustine is trying to say, it's grace that makes all the difference. It's God's choices that make all the difference. And predestination is indeed about God's choices. Let me start with a couple of definitions, and then we'll get to that notion of divine choice. Predestination, first of all, is not determinism. It's not the same thing as being coerced by external causes, right? It's not, like billiard balls that bounce around, right? That notion of physical determinism has bothered a lot of people and a lot of philosophers, especially in the modern world. But that's not what Augustine's talking about. For Augustine, predestination is always having to do with God, not with physical causes. But secondly, predestination is more than foreknowledge. It's not just that God knows what you're going to do in the future. He does. He knows everything you're going to do in the future. But that's not the same thing as predestination. Predestination is something more than that. Predestination is God's eternal plan to give grace to some people and not to others. In other words, you see, it's more than foreknowledge, and it's God's active involvement. Predestination is God doing something that determines what's going to happen to you. It's not just foreseeing what's going to happen to you. So it's God's eternal plan that we're talking about when we talk about predestination. And it's God's eternal plan to give grace to some people and not to others. And that's where choice comes in. Predestination is God's choices, God's eternal choice about who he's going to give grace to. Now, the notion of God choosing is a fundamental and very, very important notion in the Bible. It goes all the way back to the familiar notion that the Jews or the people of Israel are God's chosen people. And this is related to a key moment in Genesis where God favors Jacob over Esau. And one of the prophets in the Old Testament puts it this way. God speaks in this book of the prophets and says, "Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated." God has chosen Jacob over his twin brother Esau. And God made this choice, mind you, before they were even born, is the point. Before they'd done anything good or evil, God said, "Jacob's the one I choose. Jacob's my favorite son." And Jacob is the one who later gets renamed Israel and becomes, therefore, the father of the people of Israel. So, "Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated," summarizes a key divine choice, the divine choice that makes a chosen people later on. Well, Paul, in the letter to the Romans, chapter 9, quotes this in order to talk about how God gives grace. God's grace is his choosing Jacob rather than Esau, giving grace to some and not to others. Grace is, in fact, divine favor. And the word grace in Paul's Greek means favor. Right? It's connected to the notion of a favorite son. God has a favorite son in the Bible. His name is Israel. Right? He has a favorite people in the Bible. His name, the name of the Jews. Right? So, for Augustine, predestination means that Augustine makes these choices and makes them from all eternity. That notion of eternity is really what Augustine adds to the biblical notion of God's choice. Because the notion of eternity, as we found out earlier, has been developed most fully in the Platonist tradition. So what we get in Augustine's doctrine of predestination is a combination of this biblical notion of God's choosing and the Platonist notion of God's eternity. And at the center of predestination is God's eternal choices. That is, in fact, the thing that's so terrifying. It means that, well, God is choosing Jacob, not Esau. He's choosing to give grace to one person and not another. Does this mean God is unfair? Augustine asks. And he says, no. God is being inequitable, but not unfair, not unjust. Because neither Jacob nor Esau deserve grace. Both Jacob and Esau are sinners. We're all sinners. None of us deserve grace. So God could justly condemn every single one of us. Right? Every single one of us, Jacob, Esau, the Jews, the Gentiles, all of us could be damned. But God is merciful and chooses to give grace to some. And the problem is, of course, that he doesn't give grace to everyone. Right? He's selective about it. That's the problem. And that leads to what's called double predestination. And the logic of it is this. If God gives grace to Jacob and chooses not to give grace to Esau, isn't he choosing, predestining Esau to damnation? He's predestining Jacob to salvation. Augustine will say that. Right, the whole Augustinian tradition will say Jacob is predestined to be saved, right? But what about Esau? Is he predestined to be damned? Well, at one point Augustine does seem to say that, and some Augustinians like John Calvin will bite the bullet and say yes, Esau is predestined to be damned. That is one of those hard doctrines. Well, why does God choose one person not another? Right? Remember, this is before Esau and Jacob were born. Right? This is an eternal choice. It's not due to what you've earned by your good deeds. And Augustine says, well, we don't know why God chooses Jacob rather than Esau. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How inscrutable are his judgments. How his ways are past understanding, says Augustine, quoting St. Paul in the letter to the Romans. An interesting passage for Augustine to quote, since he's so set on understanding God. But when you get to the choices of God, our understanding stops. Right? The whole Platonist project of understanding God with the mind's eye comes to a screeching halt when we get to God's choices. Final suggestion. I think the real root of the problem here is that Augustine's trying to make Platonism and the Bible come together. And he often can do that because, for instance, Plato and Paul have similar views about freedom, as I mentioned before. Right? Freedom is the freedom to do good. It's not freedom from God, it's freedom to be with God. Plato and Paul will agree with that, both of them. Right? But the notion of an eternal choice, that doesn't quite fit. Right? And in the Bible, the choices of God reveal who God is. They're the way we get to know God. Right? Whereas in Augustine, the choices of God are precisely what we can't know about God. There's a problem here, and I'd like to get back to this biblical notion of God's choices being a form of God's revelation rather than a form of inscrutability. But that's going to have to be in a later lecture.